you'd like to contact the show, send us an email at liveonfourlegspodcast@gmail.com or get involved in the conversation on social media. Join the Pearl Jam Podcast Community Group on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @liveonfourlegspod.
How come you make all this noise for us, which we truly appreciate? And I just, well, I don't want to go off, but... so I won't, forget it. And away we go!
You're listening to Live on Four Legs, the live Pearl Jam podcast experience. Featuring
Mr. Stone Gossard. Fucking Cameron in the truck. Mr. Boom Gasper! You can call me Al, you can call me Ed, you just fucking call me, why don't you?
Everybody now, welcome to Live on Four Legs, definitive live Pearl Jam podcast, and we have two shows under our belt. We have done both Vancouver nights, and we essentially kind of have this blueprint of what's going to happen in 2024. We know what the Dark Matter songs sound like, we know kind of the structure and positioning for those songs, and we also know the balance between some of the hits and rarities that aren't on the record. So a lot to get into. I'll get into that in a second, but also we're doing Sacramento 1998 today. And of course, that's going to prepare us for the Sacramento show that is happening next week, of course. So why not get into all that right now? Randy Sobel over here. For now, it's just going to be me because I'm re-recording this on the Tuesday night after the shows had happened, and originally we were supposed to re-record it. John couldn't show up to the recording session, unfortunately, but he'll be in this episode once we start talking about Sacramento. And I'm just going to make this brief and make it quick, because hopefully you guys have listened to the reaction episodes over on Patreon. Again, some of the best stuff that we do, but I kind of had some time to reflect on things a little bit. And I was thinking mostly about just the utilization of the Dark Matter songs. And of course, the structure of how they did things. They had the three song kind of slow burn open that is very reminiscent to the Lightning Bolt era in 2013, 2014. And then one song that's kind of the buffer song that can kind of get you out of that, like a Soaring Song, Given a Fly, and In Hiding were used in that spot. I can see something like Animal. I can see something like Corduroy can probably be in that spot too, as kind of the transition of getting from the opening three into more Dark Matter stuff. And then after that, once you get to the 5-8 section, what we saw in the first two nights is that they were exactly the same. It was the first four songs on the record, Scared of Fear, React, Respond, Wreckage, and Dark Matter. And I think what threw me off a little bit on this was that, not that they were played in a row like that, I guess I didn't mind that. I think the idea and the element of surprise that this band has given us for 30 plus years is one of those unique things that you just don't get with other bands, that every single night is going to be a different set list. And yeah, the set list were completely different except for this one section, and that I truly appreciate because they know that they're playing less songs. and they're trying to get everything in as humanly possible. We haven't gotten too much of the post yield. We got one gigaton song. We haven't gotten too much further into that, but it's going to come. I feel like once the tour gets on, they're going to be like, hey, you remember this one? All right, let's play this one. But early on, they want to play more familiar stuff, I'm sure. But this section, I think in that retrospect of expecting the unexpected, essentially, which is what we've gotten from Pearl Jam, is that I guess I'm just not used to the routine, which is interesting because most bands, if you go and see them following a tour, you might get like two or three song changes per night, maybe a song that's in a different position than another one, but this is not a Pearl Jam thing. However, also what wasn't a Pearl Jam thing was the screens. And perhaps this is easy for them to set up the screens for that. I don't think that's really a thing because, honestly, the rest of the songs that have screens in the background, it doesn't matter what order they're in. So I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but they feel good with those four. And it seems like, at least from the start, that they're just going to go in that direction. And I think after sort of being able to witness that happening twice in a row, I think now it's like, okay, well, you can expect it now. And then if something different happens down the line, then you get all excited. Then you're like, okay, here we go. Got something new, got something fresh, and away we go. I don't expect them to do it exactly like that every single night because they might get bored. But you also have to think, a lot of people brought this up about the Avocado tour, how Worldwide Suicide, Life Wasted, Severed Hand were always kind of put in that opening spot, mixed in a little bit, like one would be before another, and it wouldn't be an album order or anything like that, but it was still kind of a thing that they did, which, honestly, they're promoting a new record, so they have the right to do that and should do that. And they do have the right to do that with Dark Matter as well. Just something that I noticed and something kind of look to as the tour moves on and see how that storyline develops. Another storyline is kind of the end of the set, which is interesting because on night one, we had Yellow Ledbetter, which everybody thought was going to close that show. It's pretty obvious. You hear Yellow Ledbetter, that's your sound for the end of the night. But after putting the house lights on, house lights go dark again, and you get Setting Sun. And that brings a whole new aspect to what the set is like. And I love it. Honestly, and they went back and did it on night two as well, and there's another point that I can throw in with that in a second, but it just gives a brand new personality to the Pearl Jam shows. And although Ledbetter does its job, and Indifference definitely does its job when it's around, I like the idea of starting fresh. And a lot of people suggested that maybe they could do it or should do it, and I'm on board. I really liked it so far. But interesting to note for night two is that they kind of were setting up the Bread and Butter, the Alive, the Bob O'Reilly, and you thought, okay, well, maybe it's into Setting Sun and that's the show. But after Baba was Smile, which was really interesting. They kind of throw in another one that's kind of part of that identity late in the set like that, and that's usually been a song over the last year or two that has been played to the back. So maybe playing it with the house lights on is something that they think, okay, let's get this crowd invested. Let's have a little fun with this. And you're not going to do that every single night with Ledbetter. So I like that subtle change that they added in too. And some of the performances so far have been terrific. Upper Hand is really, really impressive as a live song. I did not think that that was a surprise at all. As I mentioned the last couple weeks, that was going to be the one that I was looking forward to the most, and it still is once time Seattle comes around. But also some great performances of the older songs as well. I love the spot that Immortality was in on night two in the three spot, and just as much I loved that In Hiding was number four right after that. I think they have some room to play around with some of those songs, and maybe we'll see something like a retrograde in that top three, which I would really, really love to see. Or anything that kind of fits that mid-tempo. It doesn't have to be sitting on the stools, totally acoustic, they can kind of change it up a little bit. As long as it's a little bit mid-tempo and kind of builds you there, then I think that's kind of setting the goal. But it seems like kind of what we all thought, the Dark Matter opening the show is just not going to happen, at least at this time. So stuff to look forward to, for sure. And as we move on, there's going to be a lot more stuff to talk about. I'm sure we'll have John here, and he's been giving his thoughts on the Instant Reaction episode as well. So just wanted to tee that up a little bit before going into talking about Sacramento right here. So now John's going to join the show that was recorded this past weekend when we didn't have any show information at all. So now let's get into the Sacramento show. And of course, you all know what happened the last time that they were supposed to be in Sacramento. I was there. I know what happened. It was, unfortunately, as I believe you stated so eloquently, they were working off of duct tape and they just couldn't make it happen. It fell apart and Jeff got COVID, and that was that. They could not replace anybody else as they did Cameron in Oakland and Fresno. So that's where we were with that. And thankfully, the band decided to try again in both Sacramento and Vegas. And that's what we're going to see next week, is we're going to see a Sacramento show on Monday. We're going to see two Vegas shows over the weekend. So we should be very, very excited for that. Now, let's go back, because this is a 1998 show here. And again, this is the West Coast leg that was happening on that first leg, right after Jack had quit the band. So Matt is getting accustomed to all this. And also, a lot of what was going on at the time was Pearl Jam had openers that were essentially heroes that were opening for them, along the lines of Frank Black, from Cheap Trick, Iggy Pop, you name it. A lot of those kind of guys were opening up for them at the time. Mudhoney, if you even want to say that. And at this show, it was X. Now, we all kind of know X to be more of a common opener for Pearl Jam now, because they did a couple tours of them overseas, and they did PJ20, of course, and they've had connections. Everybody knows Ed's connection with John Doe and Golden State and everything like that. And it's interesting because at this show, X isn't well known everywhere. I'm going to guess that an old 80s punk band in 1998 isn't necessarily what the youth of the day really want. So Ed comes out and he introduces them, and people are just chanting, Eddie, Eddie, Eddie. And once you get to X on stage, it seemed like they were a complete afterthought. And as we keep going through the show, that seems to really stick in Ed's craw a little bit. It seems to really bother him that this crowd was just not into X at all.
Yeah, make sure you guys go early and support Deep Sea Diver next week. But
they've been terrific.
Yeah, yeah. But we've seen this before. Like, he always kind of takes it personally. Because, you know, X is, yeah, I mean, they had a legendary run from 79 to 84, 85. But then they haven't really done anything since then. It's not like they had, like, a new album that they were touring off of. They're kind of one of those legacy acts that, I mean, yeah, they're great, but like I said, in 1998, what are people really getting out of seeing X? Like, on some point, I get it. If it had been a show I was at, I would have been stoked. Like, I would have known a few songs, but would I have been going crazy for X? Probably not. But yeah, I think he takes it personally because he probably handpicked them to open up these shows. And like, yeah, when you see a crowd not behind it, not showing this band that you think is like this legendary band, he's going to take it a little personally.
Yeah, we'll see it throughout the night. And there's a review from Karen Rose on Five Horizons, and it seems to really stick at her that Ed is mad at this whole entire show. And it seems like everything is going back to what happened during X's set. And there's a lot to get into with that. There really is, from just some of the things that he says, some of the things he chooses not to say, his attitude. That's going to kind of define this show a little bit when we start talking about the set list. But before we get into that, this was a Patreon request from our patron. Now, I didn't even ask how to pronounce his name, so I'm going to make the educated guess based off of what I know, just from, you know, knowing sports and baseball. Now, His last name does not end with an E, but his name is Andrew, and his last name can either be said as Pettit, yes, like Andy Pettit, the Yankees pitcher, won tons of games for the Yankees in the playoffs over in the 90s and 2000s, or Andrew Pettit. I'm not sure which one it is, but I think it's fun to just kind of say Andy Pettit. So,
well, no, I mean, if you go back, there's a Bob Pettit who played in the NBA who spelled it the same way, P-E-T-T-I-T.
That's so true.
I think we can go with that.
That's fair. All right. Well, Andy Pettit requested this one, you guys. So we're going to tell his story right here. In 1998, he should have been pitching. Like, this is dead middle of the summer. Like, maybe it's around the All-Star break, so maybe he got a break or something like that. Mm-hmm. But this is in the middle of one of the best seasons in baseball history, that 1998 Yankees team. So I'm surprised
they were in,
got out there.
Yeah, maybe they were in Oakland and he just popped up.
Maybe. It's very possible. But here is the story. He wasn't with Mariano Rivera or Dave Cohen or David Wells or anything like that, but it's still good nonetheless. Seeing Pearl Jam at Arco Arena in the summer of 1998 was beyond important for me, to say the least. Of all the shows coming to town that season, which weren't all that appealing to a teenager about to go into his junior year of high school, it was Pearl Jam or bust. I was not lucky enough to score a ticket to their last show in Sacramento at Cal Expo or the Golden Gate Park show in 1995 due to a headache that was the 800 number. So with that said, I was laser focused on being first in line at the ticket counter. Lucky for me, my sister volunteered to do just that and scored tickets for the two of us and two of her friends that went to UC Davis nearby. When the day finally came, it was easily the hottest day of the summer, which was 104 degrees, if I'm not mistaken. I remember that 1995 show being extremely hot, too, so this was kind of a trend when it came to Pearl Jam in Sacramento, I suppose. And once inside and on the floor of Arco, you could tell they were a little late getting the AC cracking. My sister and her friends went off and did their thing, leaving me flying solo in the pit up front, which was fine by me. I had a good idea of what sort of pre-gaming they were up to. For Sacramento, we were blessed with X as the opening band. Now, I didn't know the first thing about them, other than their catchy cover of Wild Thing, which was featured in the movie Major League. Nonetheless, I was eager to learn a thing or two and discovered a new sound. Well, that was one person that was apparently enjoying the X set. That was nice. At least. Maybe if Ed knew that, he would have had a better night. Their set began with a leather jacket donned, Eddie Vedder coming out to introduce one of the most important bands to him. I thought they absolutely killed it. Unfortunately, there were pockets of narrow-minded attendees that didn't feel the same way and were booing them. It still blows my mind that certain people acted out in that fashion, but it was definitely a sign of the times. All the gawking being slung was not lost on Eddie and company. I could see almost the whole band standing on the side of the stage and a visibly pissed off Eddie. The band kicked things off with Spin the Black Circle, Hail Hail, Brain of Jay in high gear, barely giving anyone a chance to catch their breath. Flow throughout the night was a little bumpy due to Ed's flubbing lyrics on about six songs, directing a fuck you towards the crowd during MFC. The shot of the night that Ed took toward the crowd was taking one of the many shoes that were thrown on stage that night and filling it with a heavy pour of his red wine and toasting the crowd before chucking it back. That's kind of like a show that many, many people know back in Indio in 1993. Dare I say, a pissed off Eddie usually made for a better show? It sure felt that way that night, especially during Go and Do the Evolution. Before getting into Do the Evolution, Eddie had one last gripe to get off his chest. He asked, how can you make all this noise for us, which we appreciate, and well, I don't want to go off, so I won't. It's Evolution, baby. Happy he was able to get past that, because what followed has been an all-time moment for me watching these guys play, and that is In My Tree. Eddie dedicated that song to their former drummer, Jack Irons, who at the time I didn't know had left the band. Gotta love those pre-internet years. And to send us all home happy, the band blessed us with an amazing rendition of Yellow Ledbetter. It's mind-blowing to tell me how well the band made Arco sound that night. The arena had the unfortunate nickname Echo Arena, which was great for Kings games, but not exactly ideal for seeing live acts. My only regret that night was not scoring a show poster that was designed by the Ames Brothers. Went looking for a copy online recently, and someone wanted a couple grand for it. No thanks. Fingers crossed for a more forgivable price in the near future. Revisiting the show this week has kicked off the dust in so many fond memories from this time in my life, and a huge thank you to the band for returning to Sacramento to make up for the canceled show in 2022. I, like many others, traveled far for that night, and by far I mean New York City, and I was absolutely crushed when I heard of its cancellation just hours before showtime. Guys, if you're listening, thank you so much for everything over the years and making your return to the Northern Valley. They are listening. I know. They just are, you guys. Just so everybody out there knows. And we're very cool. We're very
they'll huddle together before the show and do a quick LO4L listen.
Oh yeah. Did you hear what they said this week? Did you hear what they said on the instant reaction episode about Setting Sun and how they loved that was the new closer? Yeah, we feel real good about this. We can go now. Yeah, they're always listening. Mm-hmm. Always. I think I could speak for all the faithful out there by saying we can't wait to see what lies behind the curtain this tour. And hey, we already know a little bit, so there you have that. Andy Pettit, it was an honor to hear from you, and good luck in your retirement. You've been retired for well over a decade now. And
Hall of Fame, right?
No, he's not Hall of Fame, but got his number retired at Yankee Stadium. Yep. That's a very, very high on honor. He's probably very borderline. It would be an absolute no if he wasn't so dominant in the playoffs. His playoff resume is maybe one of the best pitcher that we've ever seen. So thank you, Andy, and say hello to Mariano for me. All right. So now let's dig into this show. And the way that we're going to start it off is extremely rare, because this would be the one and only time we ever run into this song as an opener. Spin, Spin the Black Circle. Sometimes I think about just kind of outside of what actually happens at the Pearl Jam show, and I'm like, you know, what would be great if right now, right before they take the stage, if they just went out there and just did Luke and just did something ridiculous to open with where everybody's minds are blown. I feel like Spin the Black Circle would be one of those songs like, hey, you want to get fucking nailed in the face right away? It's Spin the Black Circle to kick off, and shit, you're there. You know exactly what they're trying to do with this show. And yeah, I guess it's just one of those things, like, they wanted to go out hard, and I don't know how much earlier the set list was made. Maybe this was an audible where Ed was like, fuck it, I want to come out a little bit angry, I want to come out a little bit aggressive. Maybe they had a plan originally for sometimes or release or something like that, but it did seem like they were trying to put out a statement pretty early.
Absolutely. When you come out with a song like this, you're setting a tone for the rest of the show, and you're saying, nope, we're not fucking around tonight. Especially the first three, like Andy said, just do not let up. Spin the Black Circle is great. I mean, it's one of my favorite songs. It was my favorite song for a while back when Vitalogy came out, so would have absolutely loved this. But it definitely is a different vibe to open a show than you would get. I mean, you look at the show before this, they'd opened with Release. show afterward, they would open with Corduroy, sometimes looking at Down the Line. Like, those are different kind of shows. But when you open up with Spin the Black Circle, I definitely think that he's got that X set on his mind, and he's a little bit pissed off from the beginning. We're going to see it kind of progress as the show goes on, but right from the jump here, it's like, nope, we're not fucking around tonight. You're going to get us at our most pissed off.
Yeah, and while he's pretty pissed off, he's pretty aggressive, it seems like the rest of the band is just very laser-focused, and especially Stone. Stone has some amazing, amazing faces in this and amazing expressions in this, and the way that he's strumming on Spin the Black Circle, that's like just a machine going right there, like just watching him at the show. And it's great that we had all the video, the full show here. Just watching Stone was probably one of the best things from watching the video, and he was terrific on one of his great riffs that he's ever had. But Spin the Black Circle is going to go into Hail Hail into Brain of J. You have kind of Vitality to No Code to Yield, sort of getting the last three records back to back to back there. And yeah, you got to think, Cameron, we're going to talk about a song from No Code that would be Cameron's first appearance on much later in the set. But Hail Hail's always been a song where people have been like, this is a Jack song. I don't like how Cameron plays on it. And I never understood that, because I understood that Jack is exceptional on it, but I never understood why there's Matt hate on it. I think that, especially here, he sounds terrific. Honestly, he's driving the song. It's very energized, and everybody's very animated on stage during this, but Matt really hammered the song home and just gave this a ride. I thought it was great. I don't know why people are so down on that. And granted, he's not an official band member yet, so he is staying traditionally close to what Jack did with the song. And later, yes, he would change it and kind of make it his own a little bit, but it sounds great here. I had no problem, and I really like this version of Hell.
Yeah, this is only Cameron's, I think, 18th show with the band, so very, very early on. But yeah, I mean, this is right in his wheelhouse. It's not a Who You Are or something like that where he's not going to be familiar with. I think this is one that they probably pounded out right away in rehearsals. Like, yeah, he'll be able to get this one. I think they played it almost every night on the tour, which makes sense as well. But, and Brain of J2, these first three, you mentioned Stone at the beginning. I thought Stone had a fantastic Brain of J as well. Like, again, like I said, like, that's one thing I always look for in the videos too, is watching Stone to see how into the groove he is and what his attitude is for the night. And this one, he's, yeah, bouncing all over the place, doing all the Stone things. It's very cool to see.
Yep, Stone was absolutely flying on the solo. Sounded tremendous. And you can even tell Brain of J, you can tell him in Spin the Black Circle. Hail Hail a little bit less, but you can tell that there is the anger that's coming out. And Brain of J is something that Ed kind of lays it out on the line for. You feel some of that frustration in there. Absolutely. So the change of pace is coming with Given a Fly going into Corduroy. A lot of groove into Given a Fly here. Ed's vocals are interesting because it's kind of fluctuating from melodic to shrieking almost without any in between. And again, that can kind of go into just his mentality of the night. I'll address it later, but I really wonder how much he had been drinking, especially from the point of watching X's set to the point of going on stage. Yeah. It will seem like later that Ed was not in a good state of mind, but this version of Given a Fly really fits in with the era because it's way more of the pocket tempo kind of song. Corduroy, however, I think is the highlight of these because it has an excellent build, usually very tense and riffy in the beginning, but this one kind of felt like it soared and was more melodic than usual on the intro. It was very interesting. You don't get like that tone of, you know, where you want to like clap your hands and stomp. This one just kind of went into the atmosphere and felt like it was sort of a part of Given a Fly almost in the same kind of aspect that Given a Fly gives you.
think maybe Mike picked up on some of that because the solo is very different as well. I think the solo fits that vibe a little more than normal corduroy solo would. I think he probably picked up on that and noticed it. But yeah, I mean, Ed starts that on the guitar, so the rest of the band's going to take their cue from him. And when he puts a little more feeling and a little more passion into that intro.
Well, it's not just Mike doing something different on the corduroy solo. This is known in the community as Slideroy, because Mike is using a slide pick on this, and it sounds amazing. I mean, like, it's very, very bluesy. It's not something that you usually get out of corduroy. This is kind of held for something like a Red Mosquito sound or a Rat sound or something like that, and I liked kind of where they went with it. I liked his direction, because you usually kind of get something that's a little more in your face, that's a little bit more piercing with corduroy and kind of a full-on shred. But this one, again, I guess going to what you said there, felt like it was able to soar a little bit more just because the slide pick kind of made it opened up. So of course, then this is the only time he's going to show up on this episode here, because the slide is a pretty big deal, but he's going to talk about some other things outside of the slide as well. So let's introduce Javier here to talk about Slideroy and what makes this version so unique. So to the Sultan.
Hey, Randy. Hey, John. Hey, everyone on the podcast. So we have a tour going. Yes. What a first night we had. So if you haven't checked the reaction episode, please do so on our Patreon website. This is my first time interacting with the rest of the guys in these kind of episodes, so I was super excited about that. Late night, but totally worth it. So let's get back to business. We are covering Sacramento 1998, and we're going to talk about corduroy. You're like probably thinking like, oh, why? Well, let me tell you why. Have you ever heard the solo at the end for corduroy when you have a slide guitar? I haven't, so I think it spiked everyone's attention because it was very unique to hear. If you're wondering what is in a slide guitar, or what is the use of the slide on a guitar string, it's basically one finger fretless guitar. It's kind of like a wobbly tone. It seems to be out of pitch, it seems to be out of tune, but that's the wonder about that. Now, a really good tip, if you're one of those guitar players that you haven't figured this out yet, grab the slide and always play and always press the string towards the treble of the strings, meaning towards the lighter gauge strings. That's how you're going to get the tone that you're looking for, and that's how you're going to start to figure it out where are the spaces that you need to hit to create that perfect like pitch and intonation that you're looking in your solo or when you're using the slide. So that's something that you can do. But yeah, anyways, circling back to the solo, it's super interesting, but creates a different dynamic. It's less frontal, is less powerful, but also it has a lot of color to a solo that is already complex enough, because as you know, we never get the same solo every night. And also as a recap too, this is the year where the guys, especially Mike, he was trying with so many different backlines, Marshall, Oranges, Fender Basements, and everything was run by Fender Basements and JTM 45s and JCM 800s, which are made by Marshall, that you can see kind of like the left side of the stage when you see those years. Stone running the HC30 matchless combo and the Savage combo, super solid sound. But yeah, we wanted to talk about this week because it was something different that caught everybody's attention. and also trying to describe a little bit of what was going on that area. The other thing that I always get asked is like, okay, so when they have multiple amps on the stage, it's like, are they running everything at once? I don't think so, except for this tour. I think 1998 was the tour where everything was being run at the same time to create a mix of sounds in between the different amps. So yeah, there you have it, guys. See you anytime soon.
All right, Javier, thank you so much. And that might be your final segment of the episode, but hey, you'll be back next week. No big deal. We'll see you. We'll talk to you then. Okay, like last week, we had mentioned that this combo was very common within 1998-2000, going back-to-back, MFC into Habit. And it happens again here, again, 2000. I think both years really were the prime of that. And then once you got into 2003, they kind of stopped. I think Habit was kind of dropped from the sets a little bit more. And then a little later, MFC would get dropped from the sets a little more. But MFC has a pretty interesting talking point. So as Andrew mentioned, he starts to say right before the fuck it part, he says, fuck you, which seems to be blatantly directed towards this crowd.
Very quick too, and I think he even comes back and says fuck it again real quick after that, almost like he kind of did it in spite of himself, like it was like an unconscious thing that he was just let out. But yeah, I can't remember another MFC where he does this. So yeah, I think he's starting to feel it a little bit. He's gonna start to lose it a little bit, but that's gonna come back in Habit too. We're just screaming fuck you at the end. We know him, he wears his emotions on his sleeve, and he's not happy with this crowd.
Yeah, so apparently all night, and you see it a little bits and pieces, but you don't see anything like hit the band. This was not Indio level, but people are throwing stuff on stage, and he does get a hand of a shoe. And of course, going back to that Indio show where he poured the beer inside the shoe, as mentioned before in Andy's story, he pours it inside and takes a little bit of a swig. And yeah, I mean, he's definitely in a weird state of mind here where it's just like, fuck it, I don't care. Like, I will feast on your footwear.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a dude that used to drink the bile at Lollapalooza from the Jim Rose Circus. So he's done worse.
Yeah. It's just part of it. I'm sure. I feel like he did that in a more recent show, but honestly, it's not even come to mind, but I highly doubt that he would be that inebriated at a show again to do that. But look, Habit, you mentioned it. It does have that aggression, especially at the end. It does get pretty cutthroat there. You know, Matt starts to kind of lead the train off the tracks a little bit, and it becomes an image of rage and expression. Like you said, Ed at the end screaming, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. It's pretty intense. It's pretty intimidating. And even in this, usually they'll take the moment. Obviously, we all know with Habit, like, okay, what is he going to say in that middle? Like, what's the speaking as a child of part? And he just decides, nope, you're not getting that tonight. I don't feel like it.
Yeah, leading into a really intense jam at the end too, not just him yelling, but the whole band seems to like pick up on it. Like a song like Habit is gonna benefit from that intensity and energy, where at the end they're all pushing, just going for it completely in it. Really, really cool. I really like this version of Habit.
this section here, this is in the middle here. It's going to start kind of taking a little bit of a turn, but this is, if you want to call it the greatest hit section. Yeah, it is greatest hit section a little bit. So Even Flow to Jeremy to Daughter. In Even Flow, yeah, you're getting a lot of lyric flubs in this. And I actually don't mind this lyric flub. He does the few and far between all the legal halls of what's supposed to be halls of shame. And it says he does Hall of Fame. And I'm like, well, I can't get on him for that because I sometimes do that too. So that doesn't bother me at all. But like,
he was thinking about Andy Pettit.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. He's like, oh, yeah, of course he's going to be in a Hall of Famer. Yeah. I mean, he was what, like second or third year into the league at that point? Probably like third or fourth. Yeah, he was destined for Hall of Fame at that point. I think you asked any Yankee fan, they would say, oh, yeah, of course he's going to be a Hall of Famer. They probably still say that now. Of course they do. But, yeah, this is the start of kind of a weird point in the set. I mean, the solo here is pretty involved. It's got a lot of whammy bar sort of tricks. It's a bit short, too. And it almost kind of felt like the band lost the song a little bit, breaking back into the end, but it kind of figures itself out. It really just all turns on its head once it gets to Jeremy.
It just seems like bad vibes on stage. Like sometimes we come on here and everyone's locked in and the band's on it, but it didn't feel like that at this show.
My problem is 100% with Ed. I think the rest of the band was at least giving it the effort. It's not very often where I can say about Ed that he just didn't give a shit on this night and he gave up.
And I'm interested. Yeah.
Totally lackluster. Like, you know how he sings Jeremy. And granted, there has been this era of post 10 where, yeah, he didn't like Jeremy very much. He would kind of take matters into his own hands with changing some lyrics or, you know, expressing it a different way. But in this, the expression is, yeah, we did this song a fucking million times. And guess what? I know you like it. That's why you're here, because of Jeremy. But you fucked up by not giving X a chance. So this is my fuck you to you. And it does not get the treatment that you expect this song to. It's just the fact he's off key in spots, his hands are in his pocket. He does kind of an angry hand gesture during the fuck part. Like, you just don't see from him a lack of effort ever. And this is what this is. Like, he's pissed off. He didn't like how the crowd treated X. And he feels like, I don't know, maybe they deserve this.
Withholding a little bit. It's like, you know, if you've ever been like in a toxic relationship or whatever, even with some friends, people have friends like this, that if they think that they're not being treated fairly, they will withhold. And that's what he's doing. He's saying, nope, you don't get Jeremy tonight. You don't get the full Jeremy tonight. You don't deserve it.
Yeah. And honestly, this is going to last in bits and pieces. Some songs that he's going to do it in kind of works and it kind of feels like, okay, maybe you can give him the excuse that it fits a little bit of the mood, but like from Daughter through Wishlist, it's rough. It's pretty rough here. So yeah, Jeremy is probably the worst of it all. And then Daughter 2 feels like he's slurring his words, just falling completely flat. It's just really tough to listen to. And it feels like he had one too many to drink, and he's letting that take advantage of him. And sometimes when he drinks, he allows himself to have fun and he doesn't care about fucking up, or he'll just kind of laugh it off or something like that, or he'll even sometimes get in a zone. But this was, I'm drinking and I hate you all. This does not end well for anybody. It's a nice Noise of Carpet tag at the end, one of the last times that they would do that tag on Daughter, but just not really connecting.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like, this should have been the big crowd participation part, you know, after kind of an intense beginning. But yeah, it just didn't hit the way it should have.
It's going to keep going, guys. So, look, you kind of can give him a pass on immortality, because if he's a little lackluster on immortality, that at least plays into the song just a little bit.
Oh, Cameron saves it. Totally.
Oh, 100%. No, this is Cameron at the end here. And even Mike a little bit. When you get to Mike solo, he channels a little bit of sort of the solemn mood and then brings it up. But it's the end, and it's how Matt just takes it away. Listless, but they pick him up, and I think they know that something's going on, and they're like, okay, if he's not going to do something about it, then it's up to us. And I think that Immortality was probably a perfect song to sort of mask everything that was happening.
Yeah, definitely, because obviously the band knows what's going on. I'm sure Ed talked about it to them. They're not naive to what's happening, so yeah, I'm sure they're kind of giving looks to each other like, all right, let's not let this get off the rails here. Let's pick this up. And Immortality is a good song to do that in, because Ed doesn't have to do much. Like, once he gets past the verses, the rest of the band can kind of take over and run with it.
Yeah, if you look at his mannerisms and his facial expressions, it seems like he's just staring out into space. And he's got his head down a little bit and then just kind of staring out, almost in the same way that when you watch him on a TV appearance, he's looking into the light so he doesn't have to look into the camera. Like, he's trying not to look into the crowd. That's what this felt like here. And yeah, it did not really work too well. So he comes on afterwards and says that the next song, I Got Shit, ain't about me, and hopefully it ain't about you. It's about a crazy person. This song is called I Got Shit, and that person ain't got shit, but you got something because you're here. You got something because you're surrounded by 12, 20,000, whole lot of people who think just like you. So you got something besides that. You got your whole lives ahead of you. So don't forget that. And look, trust me, what I said didn't even seem coherent. And that's because it wasn't. This was a little bit of a wasted ramble, and maybe just him sort of hiding his true feeling of what he feels about the crowd here, because it seemed like a little bit more positive. I don't know if he's being facetious or not, but I think it was just like, okay, what do I say to like really not piss you off? And I'm pissed off, but I gotta say something nice, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it felt like he had kind of gotten it out of his system after Jeremy and Daughter, and kind of like, all right, we kind of reached the acceptance part of it here, where he's kind of like, ah, whatever, and just trying to kind of make up for what had happened earlier. But you mentioned, like, at the beginning, through Wish List, and feels like he's just letting it roll off for a minute. The anger has passed for a little while.
Yeah. Look, he takes kind of a sweet ass time going into I Got Shit. He fiddles around with the intro for a little bit. Stone is, again, very classic Stone on this. He's rocking out. He's putting some of his mannerisms, of course, to the test. And he's got like that squinty face, like with his O face kind of going a little bit. And that's always fun to watch. But maybe it feels like Ed is a little more into this one. But again, he's not at full capacity. But you got to think like, okay, rearview mirror coming up. That's a true testament. Can he wake up and get with this? And you think, all right, well, the first part of the song, it's like, okay, you're digging it. This is pretty good. But then he fucks up the first lyric. He does the, I seem to look away when it should have been, I took a drive today. And that's not uncommon, but again, that's him just not focused.
Yeah, distracted. I wrote down, yeah, same thing. The jam gets really quiet too, like, I don't think
drop quiet, right?
Yeah. I don't think Rearview Mirror was doing that as much at this point yet. I think that was more of an earlier 2000s thing, but felt like they really let it sit and then bring it back up at the end. But yeah, interesting version.
It's a short bridge. It's not Ed's best belt for the Rearview Mirror part, and you know, for where he's at, I guess it was a little bit better than the takes on Jeremy and Daughter, and the outro with the strobe lights looked incredible. So the band overall has not lost a step during this whole ordeal, but it still feels like Ed is sort of in this purgatory a little bit, which again, just like Immortality, Nothing Man to Follow That can still mask that because he can be a little bit more vulnerable. He doesn't have to scream out the lyrics. He doesn't have to get intense with it and like dig into another character. And it's, I guess, his preferred style at the show. And it led to a pretty good version of Nothing Man. Like, seemed like for a while on some of those songs, his personality at the very least was flatlining. And, you know, like I mentioned, singing with his arms crossed. He's still doing that here, but it seems like maybe this is a better fit for the mood that he's in. It's a moody song. You know, they weren't at the point of making this a big time sing along yet, not even close. So he was able to just sort of be himself in the moment when playing this.
Yeah, only the 20th performance ever. I mean, compare that to Corduroy from the same record already at 120. Even Immortality, which wasn't played every night by any means, it's already at 71. So yeah, they just weren't doing it as much. But it's a song that he can kind of tap into the emotional side of it and more of the pain and kind of like let the anger, again, just for this little section, let the anger wash out a little bit and tap into it a little bit. It was a nice version.
Wishlist, I think, was just, no, they go back to, yeah, it is like just slurring words, screwing up lines, and then he's doing the thing that he used to do in Evolution a little bit, is like, well, I fucked that up, but now I'm okay, like, now I got it back. And, like, sometimes it's endearing when he does that, but when you know that he's just not himself, it's not endearing. It's a little obnoxious. It's like, okay, you're kind of, in a way, I wouldn't say doing it on purpose, but you're not trying to actually do it. So it's tough when you're in the building. I'm sure you're just like, whatever, it's Wishlist. I like the song and it's cool. But like, you listen back to it and you know how they sound in 1998 and how good Ed usually sounds in 1998. You're like, this is just well below that bar that they set. And the bar is extremely high to begin with. But, I mean, if there were three more bars, it went under all three.
Yeah, the disco ball is out, so that at least gets the crowd into a little bit. That's a nice thing for them to, you know, it's always something unique. But, yeah, not going to be a highlight from this show.
And no extra reprise at the end. Usually they were that, like the extra, I wish I was, or whatever. And he just kind of lets the Ebo ring out on this. And he's like, all right, whatever. Pass the guitar off and move on. So thankfully, I think that is it. I think Ed in Alive is able to kind of come back, figure himself out, find the energy, and do it. And it was a strong performance because of that. I think he had a little bit more fire under him. And, you know, maybe it was because the band was able to push him on this. It didn't feel like with the efforts of the band and something like Rearview Mirror that they were able to push him, but something in his mind probably just said, you know what, fuck this, I'm over it for right now. And he's able to kind of go back. He is even smiling a little bit at the end of this. So it feels like from this point forward and with the performance that we see in the encore to come, it does feel like, okay, he's back to kind of being himself.
Well, shout out to the guy side stage doing the jerk off motion during a live. Is like,
saw that.
Whatever. Like, okay, dude, whatever you say. But throwing in Mike and the War Pigs tag at the end is always very cool as well. Yeah, live in the main set is not the last song. It still feels weird placement wise just because we're so used to hearing it late now. But that's 1998. The song still hadn't come back from the depths that it had reached in the mid 90s. So it was working its way back, but it wasn't there yet.
But you know what? This version of Go to End the Main Set is just nuts. It's perfect. And I'm so glad that Ed kind of found it during a live so he'd be able to have it during Go, because if he doesn't have it during a live and he doesn't really feel like going for it during Go, then that just kind of screws up a whole performance that Mike is about to go absolutely apeshit on. He's got the demon in this. Like, you get to see his finger movement on this, and it's just incredible the way he's playing, and he's possessed. That scorching solo, the strobe lights going. Oh man, this is one of the best highlights in the show because of that. And if Ed was still kind of petulant about what was on his mind, then it would have been a real shame, but thankfully he had gotten off the schneid on this.
I did just rewatch PJ20 before the tour started, and the part that sticks out the most now is Chris Cornell talking about McCready, and like you mentioned, how possessed he is and he's infected, you know, and then the cut to McCready going, yeah, he knows me pretty well. I'd say that's accurate. But yeah, this is absolutely Welcome to the McCready Show. Yeah, it just takes it over completely.
All right, we are at the encore, so let's pause for station identification and get into some good stuff, because there's content aplenty. Now, we are two shows in here. We have both the Vancouver shows under our belt, and the first Vancouver show, we decided to put up free on all the platforms so everybody get a chance to listen to it, but after that, everything that you'll hear for instant reaction episodes is going to be available only on Patreon. It'll be on live on fourlegs.com, but you need a Patreon subscription to get to it. And that's where all that's going to live. And we've had some pretty good conversations so far. And it's only going to get better from here. Wait until we get to Vegas and Seattle, of course, and we're really going to get into some good stuff and hopefully get a lot more participation out on site. So this is kind of what we've been prepping for the last couple weeks, you guys. We mention it every single week. And as mentioned, we said there is absolutely no better time to join our Patreon than right now. And there's no better time to join our Patreon than right now because of all this great post-game content that we've been putting together and getting it right from the people who are at the show right after witnessing it. It is gold. They're gems. It's getting it from the people who care, the people who live for this, and that's what's amazing about all of this. We do have a couple new patrons to thank for joining in. Thanks to that. One of them is Ereboss7, I see his name here. So thank you to Ereboss7. And thank you to Lisa IC, as well as Carol Schmidt. Thank you guys for joining in and really, really hope that you're enjoying these episodes because we have probably like 40 more of them to go. So it's going to be a lot of good content for the rest of the year. And we're just going to keep going as the shows keep going. And yeah, can't wait to get to more of them. I actually really can't wait to get off the West Coast so, you know, we can get some sleep at night because after night one, I went to bed at 5 that morning and didn't wake up till 11 the next day. So, yeah, maybe things will be easier once we get to Midwest and East Coast shows. But, nevertheless, we're putting out this great content and great to react to all of it. And also, hey, we've been doing these Zoom hangouts and we've had a bunch of people hanging out and watching the stream. So if you want to join in on that, definitely shoot over a message and we'll get you in. It's a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun while doing it. So the way that you can join up to Patreon is to go to patreon.com/liveonfourlegs or go to the Patreon app and search for Live on Four Legs or go to liveonfourlegs.com. And click the Become a Patron button. And of course, right now, along with the instant reaction episodes, alongside of it is the Concertpedia write-ups that you do, John. And it's giving you kind of the insight that maybe you don't see from looking at a set list. Some of the nuances with songs, some of the interactions, some of the speeches and things like that. What have you seen? The first one that you've done here, has it changed kind of your idea, like with the screens and everything like that? Has it kind of changed your mentality of how to write these things?
Yeah, definitely. I think after the first one, I definitely wanted to add that aspect to it and give people a chance, you know, if you were watching the band, if you weren't there, if you weren't able to watch the live stream, like what was kind of going on with the screen. So I'm definitely trying to incorporate that a little more because like we've never seen this at a Pearl Jam show before. It's definitely going to be something in years past that we go back to and be like, oh, that was the start of something. So I'm definitely trying to pay more attention to that. And, you know, definitely the encore break, overhead projector writing that Ed did, definitely, you know, trying to make a note of that because it's stuff like that that you might not remember when you get home or a week later or so. So trying to really kind of immortalize that stuff in the Concertpedia and give people a reason to go back and read those. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to track it throughout the tour and see how it changes.
Yep, I'm excited to see how everything goes in and out show through show and go to some of the stuff that'll be more rarities too, because it seems like they're bound to take out some more songs that we never get to hear at Pearl Jam shows, which is going to be great, and see what they do for the stage setup and the video on the back there as well. Because, I mean, anything is up for grabs. I think, look, Do the Evolution can easily be played every night if they're going to put that up. Like, that's starting to become, that's like a new pivot point in the evolution of Evolution right there. So that's a cool little added bonus. But I think a lot of these songs definitely get enhanced from what they do with that, for sure. And, hey, while everybody can read the Concertpedia, yes, it costs $1 a month or $10 for the year at the very, very minimum to join up on Patreon to get all this instant reaction content. But guess what? It is worth it. You don't have to hear it from us. There is many, many other people in the Live on Four Legs world who will tell you it is absolutely worth it to wake up in the morning and get the instant reaction from these shows. And yeah, again, don't take it from me because I'm a little bit biased, but everybody else says it is good material. So listen to everybody else if you're not going to listen to me. But I will vouch for our own content and say yes, because honestly, the best stuff doesn't come from us. It comes from the people like Mar that we've been getting all this detail from. So thank you to everybody that's been helping out with that so far. And if you want to help out, if you're at these shows in May and you want to help out and you want to join our crew out on site, please do. We're going to be out there for every single show. Hopefully have the Live on Four Legs flag handy, and you guys will be able to kind of find the landmark spot that people will be at after the show. I'll be posting it on social media, and we'll have something very soon for Portland, I'm guessing, as well. So if you want to be a part of that, help out, give your take on what you just saw that night, you're more than welcome. The more the merrier. We would love to hear your thoughts and opinions on everything. So just know that you're a part of this as much as you are a listener. You can be part of the show as well. There are still t-shirts up for sale for the Dark Matter Tour. You can go on liveonfourlegs.com and you can look through the sliders and you'll be able to find the t-shirt sale. It is $25 per shirt. As far as Potato goes, a little bit in limbo on that right now. I didn't quite get the amount of backing that I thought I would on Potato. The people that are backing it are very passionate about it, but I'm just not sure if that'll be mass produced at this very moment. I know that I'm going to get a sample being made up and I will show that to everybody, and hopefully maybe that will get a little bit more of the people invested or something like that. So look, but keep in mind, but if you do want to help out, if you do want to contribute, if you do want a cool shirt, the Dark Matter Tour shirt is on liveonfourlegs.com to purchase $25 a shirt right now, and it's a great shirt. So if you want to represent us out on tour, we would be very, very thankful if you could. All right, back to the rock. A few more songs left in this set. And Ed says, coming out here, how come you make all this noise for us, which we truly appreciate? I don't want to go off, so I won't. Just forget it. It's evolution, baby. He was absolutely just like tip of his tongue. He was going to say decided, nope, you know what?
It's going to come out later. He won't be able to hold on to it forever.
Nope. Yep. Right. You'll know very soon, but instead it's evolution, baby. So very, very fun version of Evolution that's going to be backed by a better man on the back end. Stone is a highlight reel this whole time. The strumming, the walking, the soloing, the hallelujahing, all that makes for a very, very, very fun version. And you know what? Yeah, Ed's in pretty good spirits on this too. It seems like maybe he went backstage, got a little back rub or something like that, and somebody patted him on the back. Maybe John Doe went up to him and said, hey, kid, don't worry about us. We've been booed before. Just go play. And maybe that made him feel better. Who knows? But back to back with Better Man here, we do once again kick off with the second verse. And just like Rearview Mirror, it's not something that has never happened before. He does get tossed up on it. I've been at maybe multiple shows where he starts with the talking to herself instead of the waiting, watching the clock. And this is kind of a little bit more laughable moment. The crowd kind of sings along with him a little bit and helps him out, and it seems like he can kind of laugh this off more than some of the other stuff that he flubbed in the earlier in the main set. But yeah, this version of Better Man is okay. It felt a little bit short and to the point. I wish that maybe they had an extension. I think we've been a little bit spoiled lately with some of these Better Man versions where it's been extended and improv'd and tagged and got all sorts of great, great stuff going along with it. And this one just kind of feels just right to the point. We see some stuff get thrown on stage. Maybe it was a pair of pants, but yeah, it just doesn't feel like Better Man. And at this time, Better Man was starting to get to be kind of a highlight. It felt like it was your radio song in this version.
This is the 101st performance, again, looking at Live Footsteps. And this is around the time that, like I said, it started ratcheting up and they started playing it almost every night. But yeah, it felt more of like a lighthearted, kind of fun version than the anthemic rockin' versions that we would get shortly later.
All right, so the next song here is a song that is going to be dedicated to Jack Irons, as we mentioned before. And this is important because when you think of You said Matt was 18 shows in at this point. You know, a lot of these songs had been played repeatedly night after night after night. I believe this is the only song that Matt is playing for the first time on tour at this show. And of course, it's very definitive of a Jack style song. It's maybe the definitive Jack style song. In My Tree and Given the Fly are probably the two that you think of that is a typical Jack song, and maybe Who You Are as well. But this is Cameron's first time on In My Tree. So I'm wondering if that's going through Ed's head, like, hey, we're thinking about Jack, even though it's our first time playing it, and maybe they were a little hesitant on giving it to Matt, maybe out of respect, who knows. But I'm unsure what the relationship was like between Ed and Jack, because it did feel like, from reading things in the past, that it had soured a little bit somewhere down the line, where Ed was like supportive of him, but also kind of mad that he couldn't go forward with this. I think he had higher expectations for him and being a really good friend and helping him get into the position that he had gotten in. I think Ed really wanted to give the favor back to him and him be able to take this journey to the end. And Jack just couldn't handle it. Jack had his own issues in Australia that were something that he really had to work on. And I think that even though they got maybe the best drummer of the time period in Matt Cameron into the band, I think that Ed maybe thought that Jack should have still had been there, and maybe he was a little upset with him that he had not continued.
Yeah, I mean, that was his guy. But yeah, I mean, from what we know, he took it pretty hard when Jack left, didn't want him to go for obvious reasons. But as for the song itself, I think Matt is trying to be very faithful, and, you know, now he'll do very different things with it. And now that, you know, obviously now they've got Josh who can help out on it, and we had some really good versions in the last couple of years. But this one, I think, really foreshadows some of those 2003 more kind of guitar-based versions when it came back, where the chord progression is really front and center and the drums kind of take a little bit of a backseat. That was new to In My Tree. This is really the first time that that happens. So, yeah, I was listening to this very intently. And for a first performance, I think Matt does pretty well. He's not Jack, but he pulls it off very admirably. There's even a moment where you see Stone and Mike kind of laughing at the end. Like, oh, that was interesting. We got through that one. But felt like maybe Matt ended it a little bit prematurely at the end. Like, they were used to maybe going off and doing a little jam at the end, but they cut it off right. Felt like a little bit earlier than it had to be. An interesting version for that reason, but those Jack versions are the gold standard at this point, and they're just trying it out to see, kind of see what happens, you know, throwing something at Matt that he wasn't used to.
Jack was so good at, with especially the intro into the song, was to make it feel really frantic, to make it feel very tribal. And as the song went on, the song developed with Cameron, he definitely took a turn away from that after a while, and he keeps pretty true to it here. But in future, you would sort of hear, and you go to the Moline show, of course, where he kind of gets tossed up and thinks he's going into In My Tree instead of going into Who You Are as they're doing the record. It does feel like more of the intro into Who You Are that he implements on In My Tree as well. It's not that much different, which is a little bit more slow tempo and a little bit more plodding of a pace instead of, again, that Octopus Arm Jack rendition. And that's sort of the direction they would go in. I think that as they would perform the alternate version of In My Tree, things would change a little bit, and then it kind of turned into what is Matt going to build the song into, and Matt started to get stronger towards the end and really, really make that outro massive, while Jack was in the very beginning just hammering away and keeping that up throughout the whole entire song. Matt just built to that moment as it got to the end. I think that's the kind of the key differences that you can see with this song and the two band members, and it's just kind of two ways to skin a cat, you know? That's all it is, and both members of the band are fine, of course. Love them both. Everybody's going to have their preference. I bet there are people out there that if they were pressed, they would probably say, oh, the best version of In My Tree is Dave Abersay's version. I bet there are people that would say that. 100%. I am not lying. I know. Yeah, and they probably have the knowledge that he did never played that song, but they would still say, oh, Dave A was the best on that because he's Dave A. Moving on. One of the other things that I noticed out In My Tree, Stone changes guitars on this. That was interesting. I don't know what that has to do with the song, but it seemed interesting that he was, I don't remember if it was taking off an acoustic or putting on an acoustic, but it seemed like there was some kind of switch maybe after the first verse or so. So
maybe that's what they were laughing about at the end.
It's very possible. It's very possible. Black is following that up. You know, I just don't see 1998 as being a spectacular year for this song. I think it's kind of in its very, very rare low point. And there are good versions from 1998. There are some really fantastic ones. But it just seems like 96, 98, they were a little down on it and come back up in 2000 and really in 2003 kind of turn into a full-fledged emotional version again, and kind of give you more of the stretch of the solo kind of extending and the outro being what it was. But I just didn't feel the same magic in this version of Black that the song historically has been known to have. I just didn't.
I'm going to push back on that strongly. I think 98 was a great year for Black with Cameron. Cameron immediately came in and made a big difference. You know, Black was not a Jack song, really, going back to that conversation. I think, you know, 95, 96, they weren't really feeling it. But when Cameron joined the band, I think it injected a little bit more energy to it. And Cameron immediately came in and put his stamp on it. I think this version absolutely soars. And I love, you know, Ed just barely singing at the end, just really getting quiet and kind of letting it hang and giving it some tension there. I love this version.
Well, I'm not there with you. I don't know. It seemed like... And you have to like put in all 601 versions, and it's tough to kind of create a balance between that. But like, I like when they can go off into something. I like when they can make it unique, and almost every single version of Black is unique. And I just didn't, I can't pick this one out of a pile. Let's just put it that way. It just feels like it's Black, and that's not a song where you really want to be saying that. All right. Porch is going to come up here. There's a lot of tension in this solo. Maybe it's due to what Ed is about to say when he gets into a little later of the song. There's a clear nod to the frustration that he'll express for real following this. Finally out, we finally know the truth. He doesn't say X specifically here, he will in a second, but yeah, that's the story of this whole thing. That's what we've been kind of teeing up and building to here. So, yep, he was not happy with it.
Yeah, he says that and he kind of off mic a little bit, goes, fucking piss me off. He finally gets to him and he has to say something, but this is a really kind of dark effects heavy version of Porch as well. I mean, they weren't playing this a lot at the time. I mean, it hadn't been played in a couple of weeks. Only got played, I was looking at this, 13 times in the whole tour. So this was kind of a rare appearance for this. And evidently they'd soundchecked it, and they soundchecked Alone as well, which was in the middle of a 10-year drought. That would have been really interesting to pull out of something like Alone. But a weird version of Porch, not the revved up kind of balls to the wall pulsating version that you were used to getting a couple of years earlier.
Yeah, I get that he was in a bad mood here, and he really held on to that grudge the whole entire show, it seemed. He had little pockets of, like, you know, spurts of energy and positivity, but unfortunately, you know, sometimes things happen. I get into this mood sometimes where if I see something and it really hits me the wrong way, it will affect my mood. You know, and it could be something that I'm not in control of. And that's the worst thing when you're not in control of something, like Ed is in this situation, where all he can do is just introduce the band, let them do their thing. And I'm sure they were terrific, and the crowd is going to respond however they're going to respond. And because he can't control that, because he wants to see a different side of this, he wanted the crowd to, you know, appreciate this. There are just times where that happens and it really affects your mood because you are completely out of the situation. I think you see a lot of it, not to get too deep into it, but I guess we will for 2 seconds, with sports fans. You see this, how sports fans get so invested in what a team is doing. And when a team wins, it's like euphoria and you're so excited. You're so happy. It makes your day. You wake up in the next morning, you feel great. But if they lose, you're feeling miserable. You're like, oh, how could they do that? This ruined the game. This was a bad managerial decision. You know, they made a bad play in the outfield, bad throw. And you get sort of pissy about it. And you have to realize that this is completely out of your control. Nothing that you can do sitting down on the couch and watching a game would ever change what happened on that field. You cannot control those players. Ed cannot control that crowd and how they feel in that moment. And it's really, really hard to separate that from your mood at the time. It just is, especially when you're so dedicated and you're so into something. It's just how some people are wired. And I think maybe a lot of it could be the sports fan in him, and a lot of it could be...
Music is his sports, I think, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, being a Cubs fan, too, yeah. It's not like the Cubs in 1998. I mean, they had Sosa, so at least they had something, but you all know how that turned out. But they were nowhere close to a World Series. They had lived this life of 30-plus years of being miserable as a Cubs fan, and... Of course, he had it with the Bulls. He had a bunch of championships there, and he had a championship with the Bears in 85. But like with the Cubs, especially, a lot of that could be shared here. So I don't know if that really makes sense to a lot of people. I hope that there was some sort of connection that can, I guess, explain a few things. But when something is not in your control, you're usually the most affected by it because, again, you kind of wish that everything was in your hands and went absolutely how you wanted it to go in your head. So just my 2 cents on that. All right. We're coming back out from one more song in the second encore. And Ed says we're going to play one more before we go, but you got to make some noise for who I thought is the better band in X. Us and our crew would not be here if it weren't for what they did. We just love them so much. I remember playing the Cattle Club in Sacramento, and then talks about the show with Bad Religion in 1995, sort of in the same way that, I mean, every time they're in Vancouver, he's always going to bring up the town pump. He's always, always, always going to bring up the town pump. So I guess Sacramento's another place. If he mentions the Cattle Club, I'm going to give odds 80% chance that he's going to mention the Cattle Club when he's in Sacramento, sure. Especially... Sure. Because it's been such a long time since they've been there. It'll be 24 years and been there since 2000. He's 100% going to mention the Cattle Club. So Yeah. If it doesn't happen, then I guess drinks on me in Seattle, guys. So, but he mentions the 1995 show with Bad Religion opening as well. Another legendary punk band that I think the Pearl Jam universe feels a little bit differently about than X, especially at the time. They were a little bit more relevant, maybe a lot more relevant. So after that, just wishes everybody has a great life. And we move on to Ledbetter. That's going to end our night. Now, I actually had written here thinking that we were going to record this before seeing the show take place. And my conversation point was going to be like, hey, maybe it's time to just let Ledbetter give it another spot. Like, let's not close it. Yeah. And guess what? It did. Yeah, they played it on night one. And then they ended up playing Sending Sun to end the night. And it just felt so refreshing that they were able to do that. And it just felt like such a different idea of what this band can bring. And then ending it on a more positive note with, you know, the lights being down. Obviously, Ledbetter's going to have the house lights up and everybody's going to be singing along. But to end it on something more hopeful that had everybody kind of filling in, this seemed like it would have been a great Firefly moment for the crowd. And I don't know if it was. I couldn't tell because the video that I watched was really, really close up. But it's something new. It's something different. And I'm glad that they noticed that with closing their show now. And hopefully throughout this whole entire tour, we get to see it more and more.
Well, yeah, that's what I wanted with Rivercross on the Gigaton tour. Like, yeah, do it last. And send everybody out on that big moment. And like the lyric in Rivercross, I think he channeled something in that, the last lyric of Setting Sun, which is, you know, let us not fade. That is a nice thing to go out on. And yeah, hope it continues.
Well, I think the show cannot continue anymore because we have no more songs to talk about. I don't really have much else to say on Ledbetter. It was pretty pretty clear cut at the time, as it's always been. So let's get into a top three here. I'm going to say my number three is Corduroy, thanks to the slide guitar in the solo. That sounded very unique and different. I'm going to say number two would be the opener for this night, Spin, Spin, Spin the Black Circle, because you're never going to get that again. And it's just something to kick you right in the teeth as they take the stage. And my number one moment, and probably the thing I'm going to remember the most from this show when the dust settles, is Go, because that is a demon-possessing version of that song.
Well, interesting. I've got three completely different ones. My number three is Immortality. I thought, you know, I was looking for a Cameron moment at the show early on in his tenure. And I think Immortality is the one where he took over and said, I'm going to show you what I can do on this one. My number two is Habit. And my number one's In My Tree.
All right there. Some no surprises there. But now we have to kind of have a conversation here about a rating. And look, there are some good things to talk about from this show. I think the highlights that we had just mentioned are worthy of discussion. I think there are other things that we didn't mention that worked really well in the show as well. But the identity of this show, as mentioned throughout the whole entire thing, is the attitude stemming from how the crowd reacted to X. After that, and Ed got in his head, and Ed felt a certain way about it, he was checked out in a way. He brought the aggressiveness and the angst very early on, but as the set went on and you got into some of the hits in the middle there, Ed just kind of said, screw it, and threw in the towel a little bit. And that makes this rating really tough. It's probably the lower half of shows in 1998. Maybe it is like one of the bottom ones just because of the attitude here. It didn't give him a lot of time to connect with the crowd. You know, at the time, I'm sure if the crowd thinks like, oh, he's telling us, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, the crowd's probably like, ah, yeah, that's funny. That's cool. And they don't even recognize it and they're just into the music or whatever. But I don't know. There are good performances from this show, and that should not be discounted, but I think because the identity of this show as a whole is exactly what was mentioned, I probably will not recommend this show to many, many people. So this is a 5.5.
Yeah, I'm going to try to be a little more generous because I do think that like the opening just rips the first three. I think they're... there's some really good stuff here that In My Tree is important. But yeah, I mean, it's not going to be in the upper echelon of shows just because I'm going to say 6.5.
Yeah, I mean, we don't get many of these. I gave a show a 5 earlier this year, and I thought I wouldn't give another one a 5 again, but here we are. Yeah, that's just sometimes how it goes down. But I think that should give you a sense of like where it does kind of stand within 1998, and that especially, I mean, the second leg is incredible for itself, but the first leg stands on its own as well. And I think that this was just one of the ones that just did not click in ways because of what happens. And that's as simple as you can say it. So, but next week we are digging into 2003. I don't think I've ever given a 2003 show lower than like a 7.5. And if I did, then it was probably very, very early on where I was stupid. So next week, I guess it should be a good rating that we are going to be doing the Vegas show because that is next on our list. And as this airs next week, we'll be right and waiting for those Vegas shows. It'll be airing on Wednesday and the Vegas show start Thursday and then into Saturday. So you'll have that great kind of look back on some of the moments going in Vegas. And I think the thing that I want to get to here, the storyline that I want to get to, is that we have Ann and Nancy Wilson that are going to join the band during Rockin' in the Free World at the end of the show here. And that's something that we haven't really touched up on, is how art is so integral into this band existing that I think that's a conversation we just need to have. And next week we'll get all into it, and we'll get into how Nancy was extremely, extremely helpful in getting 10 funded. And not to spoil anything, but that's going to be a heavy part of the conversation. So that should be very, very interesting from that standpoint. Vegas 2003 for next week. All right. Well, thank you all for listening. And if you enjoyed what you're listening to, and this is maybe your first, second episode or so, and you're just kind of browsing some of the stuff in our catalog, and maybe you aren't subscribed to the show yet, please, on whatever platform you're listening to this on, subscribe. It could be Apple Podcast, it could be YouTube, it could be Spotify, it could be anything else that you decide to be listening to at this very point in time that maybe we aren't paying attention to. And let us know if that's another platform. It could be like SoundCloud or something like that. Let us know and make sure you're subscribed so we can get all those notifications, because you just never know when a new episode is going to pop up out of nowhere. It may happen. Again, you just never know. But also, if you are on any of these places and you're able to give a rating, then please see it in your kind heart to give this podcast a 5-star rating. We have done the work. We have been doing this for almost 6 years. We feel like we deserve it. That's all there is to say with that. It's up to you to decide, but I mean, this is what we've been doing, so I think we deserve 5 stars. That's all I'm going to say about that. But if you're also so kind to, along with the 5-star rating, leave a comment for not just us, but the people that are looking to listen to a Pearl Jam podcast and know what they're getting into. If you just leave a comment saying, hey, I heard them cover this show and I went to this show and it brought back a lot of good memories, that's all you need to say. And then maybe the next person will look at that and be like, hey, I would love to get some memories brought back too. So I'm going to listen to this podcast, and then just on and on and on it goes, just pass it down the line. And maybe at some point, everybody that's been to a Pearl Jam show will get to listen to this. That would be kind of sweet. I don't expect it to happen, but if it did, then shit, we had already done our job here, but I guess we do it even more. So thank you all for that. And now let's end the show properly. This may be the end. We're here not for much longer, although we may be parting ways. Miss you already. Miss you always. the tour just keep rolling on, the shows just keep rolling on, and we're counting down the days till we get to Seattle. And you'll hear from us when we get there. So enjoy the next few weeks. Enjoy the reaction episodes on Patreon, people. And until next week, see you on the pod.
I must not think bad thoughts.
All right, sack door. Sack. Capital City. Sometimes you'll see us closing our eyes up here. We're just trying to picture ourselves back at the cattle club. I'm sure you're all there too.
Hey, what was the name of that place we played the first time ever? Cattle Club or something? There's a place called Cattle Club in Sacramento. Well, it was 10 years ago, and we appreciate you being here through the whole decay.